The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold. Shugen Roshi is the abbot of both the monastery and the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or to find out more about our various programs, please visit us online at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
This is from Master Wu Man's Gateless Gate, case 30. Mind is Buddha. The main case. Dame asked Master Matsu, "What is Buddha?" And Matsu answered, "Mind is Buddha." Wu Men's commentary. If you can at once grasp it, you are wearing Buddha clothes, eating Buddha food, speaking Buddha words, and living Buddha life. You are a Buddha yourself. And though this may be so, Dame has misled a number of people and let them trust a scale with a stuck pointer. Don't you know that one has to rinse out their mouth for 3 days if they utter the word Buddha? To be a true Zen person, stop up your ears and rush away when you hear mind is Buddha. The poem. A fine day under the blue sky. Don't foolishly look here and there. If you still ask, what is Buddha? It's like pleading your innocence while clutching stolen goods. So this weekend we've been conducting an introduction to Zen practice with a number of you who are joining us here from your own place, as along with many others of you who are coming in for the morning. And so this is a koan, and koans are part of the Zen tradition that developed in a sort of conscious way as a way of training in China many hundreds of years ago. In Buddhist meditation, there's the aspect of calming the mind, and there's the aspect of insight. And both of those are essential, and they work together. And there are practices that focus on one, and there are practices that focus on the other. But ultimately, they are to be completely integrated. Another way of looking at meditation is in terms of what is conceptual and non-conceptual. It said that Bodhidharma described the Zen tradition as a special transmission outside the scriptures with no reliance on words and letters, beyond all concept, a direct pointing to the human mind and the realization of Buddhahood, direct insight. And so these aspects of our thinking mind, our conceptual mind, and by conceptual, we don't just mean thoughts, just having thoughts, but the ways our mind creates objects of things, which are oftentimes associated with thinking and thoughts as creating objects through language, but not necessarily. The mind can still be conceptual, even when the thoughts are not present. And in that conceptualization, we create models of the world, models of ourselves that we believe in, act upon. And so to see things as they really are, to understand what is the nature of things, the self, we have to go beyond all the different ways that all the different ways that we've already formed firm conclusions and assumptions, mostly we aren't even aware of, through and with our conceptual mind, to arrive at a place that is not conceptual, that is no longer a creation, no longer the product of something that is unconditioned, unborn, undying. And so how do we do that in our meditation? And so throughout the history of Buddhism, there are different forms of meditation that direct us as practitioners to that. And so in the beginning of meditation, everybody is working with calming the mind, the distractedness, the restlessness, the obsessive thinking, the breath itself is a concept in the beginning. It has a name. We're directing ourselves to it. We experience it in all different kinds of ways. We think about it. But even in working with the breath, there is a practice of moving beyond all of that. We speak of it as the practice of being the breath, where that distance, which is the only way we can conceptualize, begins to drop away. The koan is a very powerful way of bringing all of this together. And so within the koan, the student sits with the koan, what is Buddha? Mind is Buddha. And sits with that in a way that is strengthening their concentration. And so mindfulness, samadhi are still important and still needing to be developed. Even more so, in a sense, because we're working with language, and language, we have such an association, so it sort of gets our mind thinking. And so how does a student sit with these words without thinking about them? So it's not a contemplative practice. It begins conceptually. Words, they have meaning. The meaning is important, because otherwise, why use these particular words? And so the words come with meaning, which is important, but they are not, the meaning themselves cannot convey the Dharma that the koan is trying to reveal within us as our own living experience. And so how does a student sit with the koan in such a way that it begins to move beyond it being conceptual? It's a living thing. Master Dongshan said, well, you don't do that with your mouth or throat. You don't do it with the words or the sounds. But you can't ignore those either. Matsu was a great master in the 8th century of China. He was renowned for being a very large human being. He's a big man. And, wait a minute, that was Huang Po. Sorry. He was just a regular guy. He was renowned, though, for having a great number of heirs, a great number of disciples. One day he was addressing the Sangha, and he said, all of you here have faith that your own mind is Buddha. This very mind is Buddha mind. You should seek Dharma. You who seek Dharma should seek nothing. Apart from mind, there is no other Buddha. Apart from Buddha, there is no other mind. Do not grasp what is good and reject what is bad. Don't lean toward either purity or pollution. Arrive at the empty nature of transgressions, that nothing is attained through continuous thoughts, and that because there's no self-nature, the three worlds, all of existence, are mind. The myriad forms of the entire universe are the seal of the one Dharma. Whatever forms are seen are but the perception of mind, but mind is not independently existent, it is codependent with form. Now, he has said quite a bit here. And in a different kind of way, he's speaking to what I was just talking about in terms of how we approach meditation. In aspiring to realize the Dharma, ultimately do that by seeking no thing. Put nothing in front of yourself. Objectify no thing. Conceptualize neither Dharma nor Buddha, nor enlightenment, nor delusion. Don't grasp at what is good and reject what is bad. Don't suppress what you don't like. Don't cling to and get mired in what you enjoy. Don't lean towards purity or impurity. Don't give rise to thoughts about what is true and not true, good and not good, pure and impure, so that we can arrive at the empty nature of all transgressions, all actions, and realize that nothing is attained through continuous thoughts, continuous conceptualizing. We are not going to think our way through this. If we could have, we would have. There have been some remarkably profound thinkers in the history of the human world. No one has thought themselves out of dukkha. Not because they haven't tried. Arrive at the empty nature of transgressions. Nothing is attained through continuous thoughts. And that because there is no self nature. The whole world, the whole universe is mind. There is no gate by which to enter. What is Buddha? The question that Dhamme asks. Buddha sometimes means Buddha Shakyamuni, that person, this human being who lived hundreds of years ago, who left home, underwent tremendous efforts for us to realize his nature. Sometimes it means you, your nature. As it says in the commentary, you yourself are a Buddha. And almost every one of us, in hearing that, will misunderstand what Wu Men is saying. Sometimes it means mind, which brings us to the koan itself. But what is mind? In seeking the Dharma, we should seek nothing. And when Matsu says, whatever forms are seen, whatever we see, whatever we hear, whatever we taste, touch, think, smell, whatever we experience that we call the world is a perception of the mind. Of course, we experience it in our perceptions. We perceive it. Otherwise, it doesn't exist to us. But, Matsu says, mind is not independently existent. It is codependent with form. And all of practice, all the Buddha Dharma, all of training, the teachings, liturgy, zazen, sacred objects, altars, monasteries, instruction, the precepts, all of it comes down to this. All of it is to help us to realize this basic truth. Mind is not independently existent. It is codependent with everything. This is the great enlightenment of the Buddha. This is the great liberation that we have essentially spent our whole lives as practitioners trying to realize directly and even more. But with all this being true, then why is there so much pain and suffering, confusion, anger and hatred, right? This is the eternal question. Right? It's easy to recognize that if we all just got along, if we were all just a little less self-centered, a little more generous, if we all followed the moral teachings of our faith or just being a decent person, the world would be a drastically different place. But so why don't we just do that, right? Why don't we just all decide, okay, let's do that starting now. What is it that holds us back? What is it that binds us? What is it that returns us again and again to these patterns of thinking and talking and acting over and over, over and over, samsara? When we get drawn into a desire, what is desire? When we're caught in a very strong emotion, anger, fear, sadness, loneliness, what is it that we call fear, sadness, loneliness? When we feel time pressing in and slipping away through our fingers, our life passing by, what is time? This is the essential that Buddhism is taking up. To understand how to be in this world, to live in peace, we have to understand the stuff of it. Whatever forms are seen, sounds are heard, or perceptions of the mind, they do not exist independently. Something is there. You see something, you hear something, you think something. Something's there. But what is it? What is the nature of that thing? If it exists inherently with binding qualities, if its inherent nature is to obstruct us, then it would do that all the time, every time, for everyone. But that's not what we experience. If that inherent negativity or quality was within us, then we would be doing that in every moment, everywhere, in every situation. But we don't experience that. The eyes do not see. The ears do not hear. They see and hear codependently. To see, there has to be eyes. There has to be an object in our visual field, and we have to have consciousness. In Buddhism, it's visual consciousness, consciousness that is experiencing things within the visual realm, and so too with the other senses. And that can seem abstract or philosophical, but it's the basis of everything that's happening in every moment. So if we think of dependent origination in relationship to, let's say, an attempted insurrection and riot and coup at the White House. So for many, observing that, witnessing that, being there on the ground, it was an insurrection, it was a riot, it was domestic terrorism, it was white supremacy as normal and on steroids. Other people, perhaps people who were involved in that, saw it as an act of patriotism, as a needed revolution, as a reclaiming what belongs to them. Everyone has a view. Probably most of us have very strong views about what happened and its rightness or its wrongness. And those views, probably for most of us, seem rather inarguable. And so how do we find peace? Where can we possibly meet? How can we know? Is it just relative? It's good for you, it's bad for me. Whoever shouts the most, whoever has the biggest weapon, wins. Well, that's been a way for much of our history. How do we know what is true? Anything that arises in our mind has no absolute quality. That's what Matsu is saying. It doesn't exist independently. Nothing is true absolutely in and of itself, void of any context. There is only context. But then does that mean that everything is relative? That is definitely not what the Buddha taught. So it can't be, we can't base it on our feelings. There are strong feelings on both sides. We might say that people on both sides love their country, care about their country, are passionate. We might say about democracy, probably, freedom. So feelings can't be the basis. Our stories can't be the basis because those are wildly different. What the Buddha realized, it actually has to be based on reality, which we cannot reach, we cannot perceive clearly as long as we're perceiving reality through our conceptual mind. That doesn't mean that what we perceive conceptually is all false by any means. But it also doesn't mean that it's all true. It has to be based in our ability to see through beyond our conceptual mind, which is biased, inclines in one direction or another, is already loaded with opinions and desires. Our cherished opinions. How do we do that? And so we go to the cushion. We take the time and apply the effort, which at times seems too demanding, too slow. Like we need to know now. (Laughs) And the Buddha said, well, we all have the capacity to know now, to see directly now, because that's your mind. That's your Buddha nature. The difficulty we have in doing that is because we have built up such strong walls and cherished opinions. And so we can get to the point where we see what is true ultimately because it is not perceived or created as true. It is not born out of an idea or an ideology. In its essential nature, it's not in the realm of good and bad. It's not concerned with past and present and future. It is a place of no concern. Arrive at the empty nature of transgressions. Realize that nothing has absolute inherent characteristics or qualities. And so then the question is, well, if we live in a world where in a body and mind that is continually creating concepts, thoughts, teachings, practices that direct us, that guide us, then doesn't it make sense that we better make sure that those are in accord with reality? How do we do that? Well, the Buddha, in essence, in one sutra said, really pertaining to how to trust whether a teacher is teaching true Dharma, said, watch them. Don't just listen to what they say, but see what they do. Study. What are the effects of practicing that Dharma in a person's life? We could just extend that to not even practitioners, but anyone who is living under a view that informs their thoughts and their speech and their actions, and just ask the question, is this leading towards liberation, freedom, non-harming, being of benefit, the dissolution of separation and divisiveness, or is it doing just the opposite? That's pretty easy to see. And then we trace that back to the mind, the views, the practices, which means where are we putting our energy, what are we devoting, what are we taking refuge in. And so when we take refuge in an ideology, a belief, a system that we call white supremacy or patriarchy, that has an extensive, well-documented, well-based in evidence history of violence beyond our imagination, that's what the basis of our discernment becomes. And so when we sit, we encounter our thoughts, our sensations, our emotions. And right there, we begin to see, is the birthplace of heaven and hell, war and peace. It all starts right there. Something arises, you like this, you don't like this. You want more of this, you want less of this. You love this, you hate this. We tell a story. A good story, a bad story. A comforting story, a painful story. In this one, we're the winner. In this one, we're the loser. We see the mind, the mind's strong inclination to seek that which affirms what that conditioned mind already is. More of the same. It's kind of like having our own personal cheerleading squad. It's sort of like being our own God. Who's explaining, creating the world in an instant. Doesn't take 7 days. Who lays down the foundation and the basis of all that exists. when we see that any action, any policy, any system is based in no moral commitment or a perverse moral commitment, which means not moral, but some other basis for discerning what is right and wrong, good or bad, that is not based in truthfulness, that is not based in equity, that is not based in compassion, we can know that that action, those policies, those systems will create suffering. It's not a mystery. So what happened on Wednesday was horrific for many of us, exhilarating for others. But should not have really been a surprise to any of us. In a sense, it was the fairly predictable outcome of thoughts, actions, words, policies, systems that have not just been flying high for 4 years, but for over 400, telling a story. And all of this, what makes it so powerful is all of this is cloaked as rational thinking. It can be explained, it can be described, it can be put into pamphlets, it can be written up as very literate, sensible . What is Buddha? Matsu said, mind is Buddha. One of the greatest challenges of Buddha's practice is that within a burning house, rather than just running and getting out the door, because that seems like the smartest thing, is that you actually sit down, you put your ass down in the middle of that burning house, and you say, let's look a while at this. Right? From a distance, that looks kind of foolish. And that's why some of the great spiritual masters of the past have been extremely courageous. That's why being a spiritual practitioner in many ways and in many times means going against what seems to be the current of things. Sometimes our own impulses. We sit down to drop into and through every thought, every idea, every belief to see what is true. Not ultimately even based on what the Buddha said. That's why it's not a system of belief. It's not adhering to a belief system. Arrive at the empty nature of transgressions of all things. Buddhism itself, Dharma itself, truth itself, realization itself, emptiness itself. An old master was teaching about mind and its relationship to meditation, and said, the natural condition of your mind is free from all extremes and partialities. So your attitude or your zazen towards that natural condition should also be impartial. In other words, if we want to see directly into the nature of mind, which is peaceful, free of conflict, impartial, that is, without any duality, that is expansive, in a way that we describe as generous or magnanimous, then we ourselves, our mind, has to, in essence, return to or discover those very things in mind. In other words, meditation is, in essence, a way of returning to our natural state, in which those qualities, those ways of describing what is ultimately ineffable, are not just in our mind as a concept, but are actually manifesting. because they are always manifesting, because that's our nature, what it really means is manifesting in a way that we realize. That's what realization is. We make direct contact. That's what Bodhidharma, but he said, direct pointing in the realization of Buddhahood. And so the teacher goes on to say, since the mind is spacious and devoid of directions, do not focus with too much focus or deliberation on your object of meditation. Not too taut. Not aggressive. Not obsessive. Not too loose. Not passive. Since the mind does not increase or decrease, don't approach it with any hope of realizing it or any fear of losing it. Matsu said, if you seek the Dharma, seek nothing. Don't be afraid, or don't hope that you'll realize it. Don't be afraid that you might lose it. Nor should you cling to the mind as some sort of concept. So why does Wu Men in his commentary say, though mind is Buddha may be so, Dhamme has misled a number of people and let them trust a scale with a stuck pointer. So you've got a scale. Every time you step on it, it gives you a certain weight, right? You might like what it says to you, or you might not like what it says to you. And every time you go on it, it's the same thing. No matter what you do, it's the same. Right? And we haven't realized, oh, it's stuck. And so he's saying, mind is Buddha can become that stuck pointer in our mind. And in other words, it's like, oh, that's what Buddha is. It's mind. And so then we go seeking mind as a concept, as an object. Where is it? What will it look like? When will I find it? Once I find it, how can I not lose it? Since mind transcends any notion of good or evil, don't approach it with the idea of accepting or rejecting. Do you see? So in the instruction that we receive in the very beginning of Zazen, when something arises, don't judge it. Now, on a basic level, that's because when we do, we get into denying and suppressing and grasping and clinging, which derails our concentration. We wander off into those two areas, and we just create more suffering. And so to free ourselves of that means the mind is what? Impartial. So we're beginning to bring that natural quality of mind to reality, which is, by its very nature, that. So that we can ultimately realize our fundamental nature, which is free of good and evil, right and wrong, high and low, where there is no hope or fear. Since mind is empty of all attributes and characteristics, don't approach it with any mental image or visualization. Now that's a hard one, right? Right? Because we all come in and we have a sense of, okay, life is hard in whatever way we experience that, but then there's this enlightenment thing. All right, let's go there. Let's get that, right? Because that's kind of the world we've been raised in. That's what we've been told the world is. That's how we've been taught the world works. And so if you don't like the reality of an election, reject it, deny it, suppress it, destroy it. Where will that go? You know, I couldn't help but wondering, you know, as these men, mostly white men, almost exclusively, I didn't see any person of color, although who knows, swarming in, occupying desks, creating havoc, destroying things, stealing things. And I thought, okay, now what? Now what? Like, what's the plan? You've gotten this. What? what do you do now? To bring forth a non-judging mind, an impartial mind, doesn't mean that we don't see things as different. Of course we do. Our senses are exquisitely designed to help us to differentiate. Thank goodness for that. Otherwise, we would be bumping into everything, right? The non-judging, impartial mind means not cultivating the mind that divides, that elevates, that diminishes. It means to bring forth a mind that is skillful rather than unskillful. In other words, if we're going to create with our mind, which we do, we must, that's what the mind does, then create what is true. Create what is skillful. Create what is not only sustainable, but is thriving, has the capacity to thrive. That liberates rather than binds. To realize that no matter how elegant, no matter how inspiring our thoughts are, our opinions, our words, no matter how valid our comparisons might be, our conclusions about things, they are empty of self-nature. They don't exist in and of themselves. So when we attach to them, they are already becoming dangerous. They're not becoming dangerous. We are becoming dangerous in our attachments. And what we see is when those attachments become stronger and stronger and reach a certain threshold, that danger is manifest. In the same way that when the eye or the ear sees or hears something, it has to impinge on our senses and reach a certain threshold, or we don't perceive it. And in the same way, our karma, these karmic seeds, have to reach a certain potential of fruition, of ripeness, in order to come forth. And so when we create conducive environments for ripening, that which is violent and oppressive and destructive and deceptive and ridiculous in terms of its capacity to be a viable path to living, to existing. You know, it's like the view of white supremacy first, like what's so great about being white, just inherently? Putting aside all of the benefits that comes, the unearned. But what's the idea, you know, of a white supremacist victory given the world we live in, given the community of people that we live with, that we are dependent upon, that we are? So while not having any mental image or visualization about any aspect of the Dharma, we do need to have a sense of the path, of where this is going. We do need to have a sense that I am moving in a particular direction without reifying it, right? Without solidifying it, without creating expectations, because otherwise I'm just wandering. I'm doing things, but I'm just wandering. There's no sense. How do I gauge my practice? How do I gauge within the 99% of the time when we're guiding ourselves, when we're not being directly guided by a teacher or by the teachings, we're guided by our aspiration, by our understanding. And so every person who says they love their country, they care about their lives, they care about those that they love, who want a better future for their child. It sounds good, but what does it mean to each person? What is it based in? What view? What is the path to that? Is it based in something that is actually true in accord with who we are as human beings and who we are when we live together? Because there are certain universal realities about that, that if we ignore, it can't go well. It can't. It won't. It's not. So how do we know what is binding, what is liberating, what is in accord with reality, what is not? What causes harm and what is creating good? Well, first of all, we have to be willing to ask those questions. And of course, when the mind becomes so crowded within its delusion, it is not interested in asking. It just knows. It wants to know. There is no space, no time, no tolerance for patience. There is no tolerance for anything that doesn't already match. And so that means we must be willing to let go of our attachments to our own partiality, to not focus too tightly on the object of our concern, to not be attached to succeeding or to be afraid of failing, to know that our thoughts and intentions don't exist apart from our mind, and our mind doesn't exist apart from anything. The three worlds are mind. To face evil without rejecting it and face all that is good without clinging to it. To not impute meaning and inherent qualities and fixedness into things or people or ideas. These are extremely challenging practices. But at the same time, they're not. They're very simple. You know, it's like when you really begin to realize how toxic the judging mind is, your judging mind is, that's really incredible, because now you can practice it and you just have to be diligent about practicing it. Right? Don't be lazy. Really be diligent, because you see how painful that mind is, how it separates and isolates you from yourself and others. So recognizing that is like, okay, now just attend to it. So it's actually not that difficult. You know, sometimes maybe we make too much of how challenging practice is. And we do that because, you know, to just sort of guard against the idea that, you know, we're just going to manage this, you know, and sort of control our way to the end quickly. So there is preparing us for a long path. But at the same time, we can build that up in our mind into an idea that if it's not hard, if it's not difficult, then I must not be doing it. Within the mind of violence, hatred, there has to be fear. That doesn't mean a person or we will own up to it. There has to be fear, anxiety. Why else? It's sort of like, you know, when we're very arrogant or prideful, it's like, who are we convincing? And within that mind of suffering, there cannot be intimacy. There's very little awareness. There's very little release, letting go. And the very idea of intimacy, the notion of awareness, the notion of detachment, for somebody who is far away from those things, which is the person who is in a very tight spot within their mind, those things seem foolish, like not interesting. I'm not interested. That's not important. That's why delusion is so dangerous. It can put us so far away from the essential things that we actually crave and need. I mean, crave in a good way. And we don't even know it. We don't even know that that is actually what we hunger for. It's interesting how much in the teachings, particularly in the teachings of compassion, there's the invocation of, you know, as a bodhisattva, when you are ridiculed, when people are slandering you, when people are throwing sticks and stones at you, why all of those references? Because within a world of samsara, of very tight, rigid views, a mind that is expansive or seeking expansiveness, a mind that is compassionate and seeking compassionate, seems ridiculous, seems silly, foolish, not even to be taken seriously, not even dangerous. So Matsu says, you should speak appropriately then about the affairs of your own life. For each matter you encounter constitutes the meaning of your existence, and your actions are without hindrance. Each thing that you encounter is the totality of your existence, right then. So in Buddhism, no moment is unimportant. No moment is without consequence. No moment is to be forsaken. He said, the fruit of the bodhisattva way is just thus. Born of mind, we take names to be forms. Because of the knowledge of emptiness of forms, we realize birth is non-birth. Understanding this, now we act in the fashion of one's time. We move in accord with things. Just wear clothes, eat food, constantly uphold the practices of a Buddha, and pass your time according to your circumstances. Live in harmony. If one practices in this manner, is there really anything more to be done? Is there anything beyond this? Wu Men says it in a very sort of extravagant way. He gives us a very rich sort of meal. He says, if you can at once grasp it, you are wearing Buddha clothes, eating Buddha food, speaking Buddha words, and living a Buddha life. You are Buddha yourself. What does that mean? What does it mean when it doesn't mean something? That's why he says, you should just run away when you hear these words. It seems true that we are in a time of spiritual impoverishment. And a time of great possibility. The best of times, the worst of times. Amidst our wealth and entertainment and distractedness and comfort, many of us, and perhaps as a culture, as a society, have become lost, have sort of lost our vision of what's important. Right. It's not money, it's not wealth, it's not buying things, it's not having things. That has been known to be true, and known to be true in a pervasive way not even that long ago. But within the possibility that exists, the fact is that each person who turns towards what is true, who cares about this life and others, even a little bit, who takes any action in the direction of what is good, of what is diminishing harm, brings a kind of light into the world. And there's a whole lot of that happening. There's a whole heap of good that is happening. Remember that our minds tend to be attracted to what is painful and bleak. And of course, we do need to see it. We do need to reckon with that. We do need to attend to it. It does need to be ceased. But also to realize that our minds don't become so tight within that that we begin to think that that's all there is. A fine day under the blue sky. Don't foolishly look here and there. If you still ask what is Buddha, it's like pleading your innocence while clutching stolen goods. The Buddha said 2,500 years ago, if we want to see into the nature, the causes and conditions of what is all of the illness of the world, stop and look within yourself. It's that close. And if we want to see what is the doorway, the passage into liberation, stop and look into yourself. It's that close. And the thing is, you know, you can't make somebody love. You can't make someone care. You can't make someone let go. You can't make someone do meditation. You can't make someone come to a path. But it's kind of like within a Sangha, the more people that are practicing within alignment, the more people who are practicing within a basis that is stable and strong, then every new person who walks in sort of is infused with that. We've seen that. It's almost measurable. That if the majority of the people in the room are very restless, then everybody gets restless. But once there's a certain kind of threshold, a certain sort of percentage, I don't know what that is, but a certain amount of wisdom, of good intention, of resolve, of open-heartedness, then everyone who walks in immediately sort of is folded, brought into that, and is affected. And their practice is different, begins in a different place than entering into a very different kind of environment. So if we just think about that, you know, just on a broader scale, that all of the ways in which there are people who care deeply in a good way, in a true way, in a way that is in alignment with what is actually not just sustainable, but thriving. That's how things change. And so in that way, we as an individual, we as a Sangha, become larger. Everyone becomes larger. In the end, it comes down to something so simple. Dogen said it this way: the water is clear right through the earth. A fish goes along like a fish. The sky is vast, straight into the heavens. A bird flies just like a bird. How is it for you? It was really nice to be with all of you this weekend, those of you who joined us. I hope it was helpful to you and that you continue on whatever path you find to be true. So thank you for being with us. And thank all of you for being with us today. It's more important, I think, than we can know. You know, I think what we do in practicing the Dharma is more important than we know. We are obviously, you know, can be so motivated by our own concerns and our desires for what we want in our own lives, and that's important. But to really appreciate that there's so much more happening in this than we know. And that's what we can cultivate faith in. And then your motivation becomes so much larger.
Thanks for listening. Did you know that Zen Mountain Monastery is live streaming all Dharma talks and daily Zazen during the coronavirus quarantine? Visit our website to learn about all the online programs being offered at this time. Just go to zmm.org and click on the link at the very top of the page. or scroll down and click on Retreats.